Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Isabel Hardman and James Forsyth. So we just had our last PMQs of this brief term before the conference recess, and Jeremy Corbyn went in on universal credit. Isabel, how did he fare?
Well, he's never amazing at PMQs. His questions were very good, I thought, in the circumstances. His first question, where he listed organisations and asked Theresa May what they had in common, said the National Audit Office, the Federation of Small Businesses and so on, was good. And then his follow-ups, I thought, were good in terms of drilling down through the problems with the universal credit and the authoritative organisations who'd highlighted those. Theresa May was much weaker than him. She basically tried to answer with a list of case studies of people who she'd heard of, who she named with their first names only, who liked universal credit, which just didn't work when you've got proper reports on the rollout of the programme. And MPs across the House, including Conservative MPs, something Corbyn also referred to by saying, we're all constituency MPs, we're all seeing these people coming into our surgeries, who are all worried about the rollout of this benefit and about how it's working. Now, I thought probably the most effective, in a slightly depressing way, answer that Theresa May had was when she started talking about the principle of universal credit and how important it was to get people onto a benefit system that worked and that made work pay. But the reason that's depressing is that it's so common for Parliament to debate the principle and to ignore the details of something, which is how we've ended up with the problems with universal credit, because it's very easy for ministers to dodge quite understandable and justifiable criticism of a policy by saying, oh no, your party just doesn't care about reforming benefits, which, perhaps Jeremy Corbyn does or doesn't personally, but Labour has always been reasonably supportive of the principle of universal credit.
Yes, Theresa May tried to go on the offensive there, James, and she made the point that under the old system, under Labour, people could claim up to £100,000 in benefits. Do you think that is a successful way to fob off Corbyn's questions?
I think there probably is a Jeremy Corbyn vulnerability here, which is Jeremy Corbyn didn't like the welfare reform that was done under Tony Blair. And so actually, if you probably got Jeremy Corbyn into the principles of the welfare system, the answers he would give would put him quite far at odds, I would argue, from the kind of average British voter. Like Isabel, I didn't think that her defence of naming individual people who receive universal credit and like it worked, because it would be a pretty poor government policy that nobody benefited from. And so it's more shocking when it's someone being failed by a government policy, when government's saying, look, we found one person who's happy. It's like Virgin Trains saying, oh, we found the person who got there on time. And it's not that impressive. So I mean, that was the issue. I was also just struck, though, by just how red in tooth and claw PMQs was today. The volume in those May Corbyn exchanges was quite striking. And Corbyn's last question, which wasn't really a question, I don't think I heard a word of it up in the press gallery. Now, partly that's because I'm as deaf as a post, but it's also because, the volume really seemed to be rising and Tory MPs were really ripping into Corbyn.
And it wasn't just Tory MPs, was it? We could see the SNP.
The SNP
I think they were shouting speech or something like that. I wondered whether it was because he saw this bit as his YouTube clip and all the other parties wanted to disrupt that, to stop him from having an effective social media session.
And I think you also saw Theresa May's attempt at, if not producing a social media clip, but producing something for the evening news, when she listed some of the things that have happened in the Labour Party in recent weeks, Press TV at that Joan Ryan deselection meeting always, and said, if this is what he'd done to Labour, imagine what he would do to the country. And I thought that was quite effective, because the big question in British politics right now is these Labour moderates who are wavering, what are they going to do? And this is the essential question. Look at what he has done to your party. Do you really want that kind of politics imposed on the country as a whole? And I thought she actually got that one right.
Now, even though it was a very bad-tempered session in many respects, one of the issues that didn't really come up and in an offensive way to Theresa May was Brexit. And that is partly because we've had enough Brexit drama probably in the past 12 hours away from the chamber, which is after the European Research Group of Brexiteers held a meeting last night where apparently a plot was on the agenda and they were openly discussing how to bring down the Prime Minister, when to submit letters and what the best tactic is. Isabel, today we've seen a bit of a rollback operation in action, haven't we?
Yes, it wasn't just the fact that it was only really two loyal backbenchers who asked questions about Europe at PMQs today. It's also that following the reports of the ERG meeting last night of the plotters to get rid of Theresa May, talking about how best to undermine her. You've had leading Brexiteers coming out saying, well, I'm not part of that. I don't think this is acceptable. People like Ian Duncan Smith, for instance. Others pointing out that leading Brexiteers weren't at this meeting, such as David Davis, Bernard Jenkin, and so on. Basically trying to take a little bit of a step back. You don't really want your plotting to be that public. If you're trying to mount a leadership challenge, it's got to be effective by being private rather than having these sort of blue sky thinking sessions being reported live to the media. I think Downing Street would have been quite relieved that the meeting went that way last night.
And also today, in response to the James, you've almost had David Davis and a few others pledge allegiance to the Prime Minister. Should we take them at their word?
I think there's this. This is, I mean, we're saying in the magazine coming out tomorrow. The fundamental problem for the opponents of Chequers is this, is at the moment they have enough votes to force a no-confidence vote. But Theresa May would then win that no-confidence vote, and that produces two big problems for them. First, it means that there's a year where she can't be challenged again. So she could make more concessions in that period, and they wouldn't have the weapon there, which they currently have, say, oh, hang on a second, you've done that. So I think that's why these people... It's not that... I don't think it is that Steve Baker, who was at the meeting but kept trying to stamp on the conversation. I don't think it is that Steve Baker really is desperate to see Theresa May stay as Prime Minister come what may. It's more that he realises that an unsuccessful attempt to remove her actually puts the Brexit ultras in the party in a weaker position than they are now. And so I think what you see what's going on is, you know, at the moment, Number 10 believe that they have no room for political manoeuvre. So if those people like, for example, Philip Hammond, who would be in favour of some further concessions on issues to the EU, come, Number 10 can say, look, we really cannot do that. If there was a no-confidence vote and she won it with a, you know, majority of 100-odd, you can imagine it wouldn't take very long to think of the three or four cabinet ministers who would immediately be tooling down Downing Street saying, look, you're free, you're liberated from these people, let's do this, let's do that. And so that, I think, is what the cannier Brexit ultras have realised.
Now, this week we were supposed to be getting a Brexit manifesto from the ERG to rival Theresa May's Chequers plan. That hasn't happened. But yesterday we had several Brexiteers, Steve Baker, Boris Johnson, attend the launch of a report about the merits of a no-deal or a, correct me, world trade Brexit. And then today we've heard about the Irish border, and there's been a launch about what the ERG would suggest to get around the Irish border problem. It's about, are they starting to look like a more united force as we go into the second half of the week?
The second half of the week. Well, they've had a report that Nigel Dodds has endorsed in terms of the Irish border, which has probably been a boost for them. But they haven't. They've definitely looked slicker than this over the past few months. The past week or so, things have started to fall apart a little bit. As you mentioned, there have been disagreements over whether to produce these particular reports, to whether they can get Boris Johnson on board and that sort of thing. And I wonder whether that's because people are starting to split off a little bit and start thinking about leadership challenges as well as the principle at stake.
James, is this a good or a bad week for the Brexiteers?
I think the most interesting question here...
Let's
go back. Let's look at what Jean-Claude Juncker said today in Brussels. This is way more important than any of the stuff that's happening in Westminster, which is that, you know, the EU still cannot accept Chequers, right? So this is the fundamental... They are not going to say, right, you can basically stay in the single market for goods, but not for services, and not accept free movement. So Chequers still isn't happening, right? So this is the point. So either she has to make more concessions, which at the moment, for the reasons that we discussed, she cannot do. Or she's going to be forced back, I think, towards something looser. And I think this is the fascinating question, which is she prepared to make that tactical shift? She's not exactly noted for the speed with which she likes to make tactical shifts. And if she doesn't, that growing group of cabinet ministers who fear that what will happen if she doesn't move is that at the last minute, basically, Barnier will basically say, well, it's really a customs union or no deal. And at that point, because Parliament wouldn't vote for no deal because the UK isn't properly prepared for no deal, the UK ends up in a customs union with the EU, which, to my mind and to the mind of lots of Brexiteers, would not be in the long-term interest of the UK.
Now, finally, next week we have two big events. We have the Salzburg Summit with Theresa May, and we have Lib Dem Conference. James, firstly on Salzburg, what are we expecting Theresa May to get here when she meets with the EU leaders? Do we think there will be a breakthrough?
Warm words. That is what we expect. And you talk to figures in the government intimately involved in negotiations, and they basically say there's not going to be kind of there are no papers at Salzburg, so it's not like everyone's going to sit down and get into the detail. But I think they will say some things designed to help her through Tory conference, because, and make of us what you will, they really don't want to end up negotiating with a Boris Johnson figure or a Jacob Rees-Mogg figure. But they want to keep Theresa in place because they think that they can do a deal with her. So I think we will get some warm words. What I don't think we will get is a kind of declaration of, oh, we've looked at Chequers, it's great, let's just get this done. I think you'll get a kind of, oh, this is a very interesting proposal and we've made progress, kind of something. And hopefully, I think it's at the moment in number 10's sheet of warm words about Chequers, I think the Lithuanian foreign minister, or maybe I'm getting my Baltic states confused, has star billing. I think the hope is to get something a bit more senior and a bit more effusive to try and get her through conference.
And now it's about the other biggie, Lib Dem conference. What level of excitement is there in Westminster ahead of this? We've heard about a moderate momentum perhaps launching. Are you getting anything on that?
I think Westminster has reverted to not entirely being sure why there is a recess week for Lib Dem conference.
I've taken a holiday.
Yeah, I think that there's a few people who are doing that. It will be interesting to see how Vince Cable repitches his party as this movement of the moderates, and how he manages to make it more of a sort of campaigning party rather than what it is at the moment, which it's got a lot of people, and this is a criticism that has sort of sparked this change. It's a party that's got a lot of people in it who want to be members of the Federal Policy Committee and to ensure that they can, you know, have a hand in writing the back page of the manifesto and that kind of thing, as opposed to something that's campaigning on sort of values-based issues. So it will be interesting to see if he can do that. He hasn't seemed that hopeful about the future of the Lib Dems as the Lib Dems, given he was saying, well, you know, we could rename it last week. And whenever you talk to Lib Dems privately, they will start talking about the need for a new party very quickly. And then they'll sort of go, oh, yes, but, you know, I'm a Lib Dem, as though they've forgotten that they do actually have a centrist party at the moment,
which is polling on around 6%. Thank you, Isabel. Thank you, James. And if you like this podcast, please do remember to subscribe on the iTunes store. And why not leave us a review if you really like it?